Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. You know, if there's one universal truth out there, it seems true in all eras, at least for the last 2,000 plus years. It seems true today. It seems true almost across the entire political spectrum. Certainly in the Democratic Party, in these primaries, you can see it. But even in the Republican Party, you can see it quite a bit, particularly with Donald Trump. That universal truth is a hatred, a distrust of banking, of bankers, of financiers, of Wall Street, of, you know, for Donald Trump, it's those evil hedge fund guys. Right? For Bernie Sanders, it's, I think, every banker he could ever think of. Right? I mean, Donald Trump is literally accused hedge fund managers of getting away with murder because of tax benefits that, you know, real estate guys basically get the same kind of tax benefits. And yet, when he says that on hedge fund managers, the audience cheers. Audience cheers. Hillary wants to regulate them. Bernie wants to basically regulate them even more, much more. Than Hillary does. Republicans jump in with, on the one hand, wanting to repeal what they call Dodd-Frank, which is this major regulatory legislation. But on the other hand, so what? So you repeal one little piece of regulation and you leave the financial industry the most regulated industry in the country. So really universally, to one extent or another, even among libertarians, if you remember 4 years ago and 8 years ago, the Ron Paul campaign, he would, almost in every single debate, Ron Paul would chime in against Wall Street, against bankers, not against the current state of affairs, not against the overregulation, not against the rotten incentive structures that are being created by regulations, by deposit insurance, by too big to fail, by all the things that government does. No, he would rile against bankers. And I'm not just talking about the Federal Reserve and central bankers, but bankers, Wall Street, financiers. And this has a long tradition, even among libertarians, going back to my Rothbard and others who, and to this day, who hates fractional reserve banking, and we can get into that, particularly if you guys are interested. But there's a real sense in which throughout history, again, throughout modern history, we'll call it the last 2,000 years, there's been a real distrust of banking, of financial institutions, of financial transactions, particularly complex financial transactions. So if you look at derivatives, almost nobody likes derivatives. They spew hatred when they talk about derivatives. Of course, almost nobody understands derivatives. Almost nobody understands their function. Almost nobody understands the value that they create. And that's part of the hatred, and we'll get to that. There's a certain level, there's a huge level of ignorance associated with this hatred. But you can see that, for example, one place that you can see that very clearly is with derivatives. Everybody wants to control, regulate, limit derivatives. Everybody, almost everybody, blames the financial crisis on one derivative or another, CDOs, CDSs, something that has an acronym that nobody can actually spell out, and certainly nobody, or very few people, can actually explain what they do. We love dragging bankers and financiers in front of Congress and spewing hatred against them and lambasting them, often from the complete perspective of ignorance. You know, often these senators, spout out statements about derivatives in particular and have no clue what they mean or what they are. So, you know, across the political spectrum, and again, throughout history, every financial crisis, every economic crisis is almost always blamed on bankers. FDR really, I think, won the campaign of 1932 based on demonizing bankers and demonizing Wall Street and demonizing finance as the cause of the Great Depression. You could argue that Obama did the same thing in 2008, although there was nobody on the Republican side in 2008 actually explaining what actually happened in the financial crisis, nor was there anybody, as far as I know, in the 1930s actually explaining what happened in the 1930s and with the Great Depression and why it wasn't Wall Street and bankers and greed that caused them. Of course, you see it in popular entertainment. You see it across the board. The movies that are made almost always depict bankers as monsters. I think we did a Christmas show here at Christmas when just a few weeks ago, and I discussed the movie It's a Wonderful Life and how the villain of the movie is the successful banker and the hero of the movie is the failed banker. But that is typical. Whether you go to Wall Street, the movie Wall Street, I don't know how many of you have seen it. The excellent, excellent movie portraying a Marxist agenda, a Marxist anti-capitalist, anti-banker, anti-Wall Street, anti-financier agenda. Very, very successful in doing that. Oliver Stone, who is an explicit Marxist, made that movie, but a brilliant movie. Very, very well made. Very, very well done. So the movies right now, there's The Big Short out. It's got an Oscar nomination. I don't think it's going to win a lot, but it's the critics like it. It's been, you know, who knows? It might win some awards because of the fact that it depicts bankers and derivatives as evil and as causing the financial crisis. Now, I haven't seen the movie, so I'm not going to overly judge it. But it's not a reach to say that it is a movie in the tradition of the many movies that have depicted bankers and financiers as the enemy. And of course, this has roots going back to Jesus kicking them out of the temple and overthrowing, you know, turning upside down. And what is the sin that the money changers were making? They were exchanging currencies in a sense. They were currency exchangers, and they were taking a commission off of the exchange, just like when you go through the airports and you want to exchange dollars for euros or francs. Well, there are no francs anymore, right? Euros or British pounds, or as I'm going to have to do, Japanese yen. They take a commission. They're providing a service, and they make money off of it. And of course, Jesus viewed that as bad. This is zero sum. This is you're making money off of money. And he overturns the table and kicks them out of the temple, because the temple, as a symbol of all that is good, the temple. That is the symbol of virtue, of morality, of cleanliness, is not a place for the immorality, the greed, the dirt, the filth that is the money changer. So you see that, you see it deeply ingrained in the Christian religion, and to some extent we'll talk about this in the Jewish religion, but much more so in the Christian religion. And that's why I think Jews have tended to be bankers and financiers and so on, and moneylenders, whereas in history at least, Christians were forbidden from those activities and viewed them as immoral and wrong, which left this opening for Jews. And of course, somebody on the comment section has mentioned, even finance professors like Nassim Taleb have a negative perspective of bankers and argue that bankers are utterly immoral, that there's something inherent in the activity of banking that is ultimately immoral. I mean, Dante places moneylenders on the seventh rung of hell. And if you've ever seen paintings depicting Dante's Inferno, what you see is moneylenders often looking like Jews, often with like a Jewish nose, with a bag of money, a bag of gold around, you know, draped around their neck, and the gold is pulling them down. You know, the weight of gravity is just pulling them down towards the fires of hell. Very powerful imagery. It's very powerful in Dante, and it's very powerful in the paintings that are depicting it. Even Aristotle, even the great, viewed money lending and in a sense banking as unproductive, as barren. Making money from money, it was barren, was unproductive. And I can kind of forgive Aristotle. I can even forgive Dante and forgive some of the Middle Ages people, because they didn't see the benefit of banking. They had no conception of economics. They had no conception of the productive nature of money lending, the productive nature of banking transactions, the productivity of capital. They had no understanding of the role of capital and economics. So one can understand that they would be confused about, you know, why money lending would be a productive activity. So they can be forgiven. But in modern times, today, we've learned nothing. We've learned absolutely nothing. Now, we'll get to what that productive nature of capital is, what that productive nature of money is, of money lending, of banking is, and finance is more broadly. We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a few minutes. So, Aristotle, Dante, Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice. I strongly recommend watching watching The Merchant of Venice. Yeah, in my mind, merchant and virtue are linked together. So I slip of a tongue. I highly recommend watching The Virtue of The Merchant of Venice, because it's a powerful, powerful play. But you get in it all the stereotypes about bankers, all the accusations made about bankers, all that is despicable about bankers is portrayed in The Merchant of Venice. Here's a movie recommendation for you a little earlier than I expected, but maybe I will repeat it later on. But there's a movie of The Merchant of Venice, I think with Al Pacino. I think it's Al Pacino. Or is it Robert De Niro? It's either Al Pacino or Robert De Niro. Plays Shylock. I recommend watching it. I think it's a fascinating play. It's a fascinating. The movie is a good movie depiction of the play, but the play itself is just a fascinating. It shows the play shows the real genius of Shakespeare, both in creating drama and conflict, which he's just one of the greatest of all time, but also in his really deep understanding of the world of finance. He really understands money lending. He understands the Christian opposition to money lending. He understands what is up against it, right? What the Christian complaint about is, and the supposed good guy in The Merchant of Venice is a Christian merchant who abhors money lending because the Christian thing to do. And this will really get to the core of why people think bankers and money lending and finance is evil. He believes that money lending is evil to the core. Why? Because if somebody needs money from you, you should just give it to them. He even talks about the fact this is the Christian merchant and the Merchant of Venice, and this is the level of sophistication and education that Shakespeare had. Maybe that'll be my positive recommendation for the week in terms of positive value is Shakespeare. Shakespeare is a genius. I love watching plays by Shakespeare, even though philosophically they're often evil. He has such a deep understanding of certain issues, and here's one. I mean, he even talks about money being barren. In other words, quoting Aristotle's critique of money lending. Now, whether Shakespeare read Aristotle, I don't know. But he must have read some of his contemporaries who used Aristotelian language around this. And he understood the critique of money lending, that critique of money, an ignorant critique of money lending. Nevertheless, he understood it and integrates it into his play. So, Shakespeare is a true genius and truly probably the greatest playwright in history. Here's another recommendation. I'm full of positive recommendations for you. If you really want to get into Shakespeare, but more than that, if you want to get into great plays and drama and how to look at it, how to analyze it, and how to think about it, I can't recommend enough Leonard Peikoff's 8 Great Plays. Leonard Peikoff's 8 Great Plays, and you can listen to it, I think, for free on ARI Campus. You can listen to the whole thing basically for nothing. So 8 Great Plays, I think, is one of Leonard Peikoff's best courses. It's life enhancing because it'll teach you how to enjoy a great form of literature, i.e. plays, and an appreciation for great art like the art of Shakespeare. Leonard analyzes. He analyzes Othello, Shakespeare's Othello. Anyway, what you get throughout history over and over and over again is this hatred of bankers. Bankers are the villains in stories. And this goes right through the times, the 19th century, all the way to the 20th century. And indeed, the economic understanding, I mean, even Adam Smith is suspicious of bankers. Even many of the pro-capitalist economists are suspicious of bankers. What's interesting is by the 17th and 18th century, some economists have a pretty good understanding of banking. So the excuse of not understanding how banking is productive, the excuse of not understanding the productive nature of money lending, that goes away around the 17th, 18th, certainly 19th century. There are people, economists, who really understand this, who are writing about it, who are articulating the case for it. And their books are circulating all over Europe. I mean, some of them get accused of heresy by the Catholic Church, but the ideas are circulating. The ideas are getting integrated into economic theory. And indeed, by the 20th century, this is fully understood. And in spite of that, there are still thinkers, economists, politicians who don't get it, who still accuse bankers of everything, every sin in the world. Every problem is their fault. And again, you're seeing it right now in the campaign. Bernie Sanders just exudes hatred. And Hillary is trying to catch up. The problem for Hillary is that most of her money comes from Wall Street. So she has to watch it. So she is a little toned back, but the same thing. And then, of course, as we said, you're seeing it out of Donald Trump when he goes after Wall Street and hedge funds. He says hedge fund guys, all they do is shift paper around and get lucky, right? Hedge funds have made money because they got lucky. I mean, sure, some people got lucky. I'm sure some people do this are successful because they got lucky. And some people would even argue that some real estate developers have gotten rich because they got lucky. Luck plays a role, I'm sure, in every industry to some extent. Q accuse all hedge fund guys of just being paper shufflers and getting lucky is the same old money is barren, finance is immoral, there's no skill involved, this is all just paper shuffling, and it's unproductive and destructive, and these guys have to be regulated, they have to be taxed, they have to be controlled by somebody, whether it's Republican-appointed regulators or democratically appointed regulators. Everybody wants to regulate bankers. Everybody wants to control them. Everybody distrusts them. Everybody hates them. And the question is why, and we'll get to some of the answers with regard to the why when we get back after this break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
So one of the reasons I came up with, decided to talk about this today is because the Wall Street Journal ran a story about just 3-4 days ago on January 13th. And the title of the story, which I thought was true, but that people seem to often not realize it, you know, not face it. This is the title. Republicans and Democrats agree. We hate Wall Street. And yes, once it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, it was kind of obvious. That's right. And indeed, if you listen carefully at the debates, you notice this. Now, the Democrats are all out on this. They constantly talk about this. They don't stop talking about this. But the Republicans share the blame. And in particular, the kind of the populist, even I'd say the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, is anti-finance in a deep sense. Now, let's be clear. There's a lot to criticize about Wall Street. Part of why there is this hatred and part of why there is this distrust, because there is something to it. There's something to it. There's a lot of cronyism that goes on in Wall Street. There's a lot of just, you know, stupid power lusting behavior that goes on Wall Street. So when one sees politicians and bankers schmoozing, people jump on that. And unfortunately, and we'll talk about this, they almost always blame the financiers, not the politicians. This has kind of deep, deep roots, because it's not yesterday that cronyism or Wall Street started. But really, it goes back centuries. Kings, in order to fund their wars, primarily their wars, because that's what kings mostly needed money for, borrowed money from bankers. And of course, bankers didn't have much choice but to lend the king money, because if you didn't lend the king money, there were consequences. Just like today, Wall Street financiers have little choice but to cozy up to politicians, because if you don't cozy up to politicians, your bank won't be bailed out and the other guy's bank will be. Your bank will be heavily regulated and the other guy's bank won't be. Ask Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, when he criticized Dodd-Frank and he criticized Obama. Guess which bank they went after more than any other bank? J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan gets harassed constantly, even though after the financial crisis, it was one of the better banks. It was solvent. It had done fewer stupid things. It was in good shape, yet it gets blamed for everything because Jamie Dimon dared to stand up to President Obama. So this goes back, centuries. The king would borrow money to go and engage in wars. Then it was a challenge for the banker to collect. Now, some bankers paid and some bankers didn't. Some kings killed their bankers in order to get out of paying back their debts. But for the most part, they paid it back, and then they try to get more loans to do more things to enhance their own position. And this perpetuated this kind of relationship, and it got to the point where all conspiracy theories, including Hitler's own conspiracy theory against the Jews, were focused on the Jewish banker. Almost all conspiracy theories, left, right, I was going to say center, but I don't know that there are any centrist conspiracy theories. That's interesting. Let me know. Any centrist conspiracy theories? Anyway, all left-right conspiracy theories, all of them, have bankers somewhere. The Rothschilds are somehow manipulating it all and controlling everything. And this goes back to the fact that the Rothschilds, as the preeminent bankers in Europe, at least in the 19th century, were funding a lot of the wars. And were, in that sense, you could argue, in bed with politicians. And some would argue they were funding both sides of the war, because they were just making business transactions and they weren't taking sides. And if both parties in a war came to them, now again, that has led to this idea, this notion that banking and government are hand in hand. Excuse me there. Something in my throat. So there is this notion that it's inevitable. It's inevitable. This idea that banks and government have to be hand in hand, right? Certainly, since the invention of the central bank, which actually prints the money, which actually controls the product of banking, money, how do you avoid the cronyism? So, and indeed, economists, good economists, friendly economists, pro-free market economists, Carla Morris at Columbia University, who I have a huge amount of respect for and admiration for, it stated in a book he wrote on the financial crisis, again, and generally on the history of American banking, a very good book, excellent book with, you know, fascinating stuff in it, wrote extensively about the fact that he believes that it's unavoidable, that this connection between banking and politics is unavoidable. You cannot get around it. It is part of the system. You cannot avoid it. So there is this perception, I think this is part of what makes the hatred of banking so powerful, is that we have really not made the case, so the case has not been made, for true independence of a banking system from politics. Because that would require real free banking. And of course, it's very difficult to make that case in an environment that hates banks, that doesn't trust banks, that doesn't understand what they do. And again, and of course, part of creating that environment is being from free market economists like Mario Rothbard, who despised fractional reserve banking. Again, we'll get to fractional reserve banking in a little while. And therefore has this clear distrust and hatred of banks throughout American history. So cronyism is one source of this distrust, and cronyism exists, and it exists in banking in some extent more than in any other sector, because it's the most controlled sector. It has a Federal Reserve. It has it has massive regulations. Imagine if the auto industry, the auto parts, were designed and built by a government agency, and that every car design had to be approved by a government bureaucrat. That's banking. That's banking. Everything where you turn is government. So what option do they have but to lobby? Now, once you lobby, it's easy to get corrupted, and it's easy to start lobbying for the wrong things, and it's easy to start lobbying for too much power and using government to access that power. So I'm not justifying bankers in all cases, but lobbying, I mean, this cronyism, this cronyism that exists, not just the perception of it, is a real problem. And this is why the solution is not to blame bankers, not to regulate bankers even more, not to control bankers, not campaign finance reform. The solution is get government out of banking. Get the government out of the business of banking. Now, just a little bit more history, and then I want to talk about the productive nature of, or some other reasons why I think banking is hatred. The hatred of banking has a long history in the United States. And one of the points that the book by Calamaris, which unfortunately its name has slipped my mind, I'll find it. I'll try to find it during the break on Amazon. But one of the stories he tells is the fact, and a very effective story and a very powerful story, is the fact that the American banking system has been fragmented since the founding because of profound distrust of banks, a distrust primarily perpetuated by Jefferson and kind of the agrarians among Americans, but a distrust of financial interests, a distrust of bankers, again, I think later perpetuated by libertarians, a distrust of financial interests, and therefore we want to avoid big banks. We want to avoid big banks, and the way to avoid big banks is by fragmenting the banking system, not allowing banks to branch out of their town, not allowing banks to branch out of a county, certainly not allowing banks to branch out of a state. And as a consequence, by the 1970s, there were 25,000 banks in the United States. As a consequence of this fragmentation, there was no diversification, geographic diversification for banks. And because of other regulations, there was no functional diversification, if you will. Right? And because of that, Calamaris makes the argument, because of this lack of diversification, the United States has had, over its history, 12 major banking crises. 12 major banking crises, the latest of which was the financial crisis in 2008. Whereas our neighbor, Canada, never had a fragmented banking system. The Canadians, for whatever reason, never had this profound distrust of concentration of power among bankers. Maybe because, like many Europeans, they believed that they could control the banks through politics, and they didn't fear the banks controlling them. And as a consequence, while the United States had 25,000 banks, Canada has only five banks. So now you say the population of Canada is smaller. Okay, so it's 10% of the United States population. So let's cut the banks by 90%. For smaller populations. So you still get thousands of banks in the United States. How many bank crises do you think Canada has had? Zero. No bank crises in its whole history since 1776, including the whole American history. We in the United States have had 12 banking crises, and Canada has had zero banking crises with only five banks. Clear correlation between the two. And if you look at the book, and the book is called Fragile by Design by Charles Calamaris, a Columbia finance professor. Fragile by Design, Princeton Economic Press. It's a powerful, good book. Again, I disagree with his idea that it's impossible to disentangle banking from politics. But other than that, the book is brilliant and excellent, and I completely endorse its conclusions. So Americans have been suspicious of banking from the founding. And a recent Gallup poll, the title of the article about this recent Gallup poll, this was in June of last year, Why It's Still Cool to Hate Banks. And when we get back, from the next break, I'll talk about the ignorance around banks and why I think banks are so hated right now, and how the left in particular, and leftist economists and leftist thinkers, and perpetuate this hatred, perpetuate the ignorance, and how the right is completely impotent. The right does nothing to combat it. It just rolls with it. So, book recommendation, Fragile by Design by Charles W. Calamaris. And we'll get right back to discussing how people generally are ignorant of banks. Because of that ignorance, they fear banks. Ignorance usually leads to fear. And that fear is reinforced by the fact that banks are blamed everything bad happening in the world by certain economists and certainly by the left. We'll be right back after these messages.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
All right, we're back and we're talking about the why bankers are hated by everybody. Everybody hates bankers. Why? What's going on? And this is throughout history. And this is in America, the land of capitalism. Why does everybody hate bankers? We're going to take a couple of calls. But in a minute, but I just want to comment on something that a comment made in the comments where somebody said, ARI, Ayn Rand Institute's the best, but too small. It is too small. We're way too small. You don't get content like this from anybody else, not from Cato, certainly not the Von Mises Institute, which often spews out hatred of bankers, not Stephen Molyneux, not any of these guys are going to get the kind of content you get here. And we're too small. You know whose fault that is? If you don't support the Ayn Rand Institute financially, it's your fault. It's your fault. So write a check. Go to the website, AynRand.org/support, and send a check. $10, $50, $100,000. Support this show. Support what we do and help us grow so that we're not too small. Right? So... sorry, that's sidetracked, but I have to do some fundraising on this show because you guys are not paying. You guys are getting it for free, right? Value for value, guys. You guys are supposed to be traders. You guys are supposed to be traders. You're getting something? Pay up. Go to AynRand.org/support, and you can use PayPal. You can use a credit card, and you can send us a check, of course. And by the way, you can also pay with Bitcoin. You can do the Bitcoin you can do on the Ayn Rand Institute Europe website, on the Ayn Rand Institute Europe website, you can pay with Bitcoin. So just Google Ayn Rand Institute Europe. Okay, we're going to take a couple of calls to talk about why bankers are so hated. Hi, you're on Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, you're on. This is Dave from Portland.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
Good, good. Actually, I have a question about the topic, but also real quick about the way to contribute to ARI.
Yep.
Go ahead. Last month, I did a donation, and I wanted to do a separate section of the payment towards ARI General and then a separate payment towards your show. And I just put it in the PayPal comments. Is that a good way to do it, or should I do two separate payments?
No, just put it in the comments, because the comments are read, and we do allocate it based on the comments. So, Dave, thanks for the contribution, and thanks for the support for the show. But absolutely... And if for some reason some people can't seem to find the comments, or I think in the credit card section there is no comments, just drop an email to the Institute just saying, I just made a contribution for $100,000. I'd like 50 to go to this and 50 to go to that. All right?
I'm working towards it. There we go.
Wishful thinking.
tell me if I'm putting out a spoiler alert here, but sure. My question is about the role of nihilism. Is that something that you're going to be talking about anytime soon, or should I elaborate further?
Not really. So go ahead. I'll get to the philosophical cause, and there's a sense in which nihilism is part of that. But go ahead, because I wasn't thinking on that track, and you're going to stimulate some good ideas, I'm sure.
Oh, good. I was basically just wondering how much of this problem is actually the role of nihilism versus just a simple understanding, and are politicians actually pandering to kind of a nihilist culture out there, certainly I think on the left. I mean, that's just my opinion, I guess. Any comments on that?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. So first, let's say that all these politicians, I think, are pandering. I don't think any of them have any particular hatred for Wall Street, because I don't think they have any particular love of anything. They hate everybody pretty much equally. The politicians generally are haters and really power lusters, and they're using the popular, they're mostly populists of one form or another. And they are using the fact that most people out there hate bankers, and they use that in order to try to get votes. So most of these guys are going to go to Wall Street, and they're going to go ask for money, and they're going to go ask for contributions, and they're going to promise the bankers all kinds of nifty things. And then they're going to go outside, and they're going to nail the bankers, and they're going to slam them, and going to hate them and everything, right? And so it's certainly a popular strategy. But I wouldn't say that the American people are nihilists in their hatred of bankers. Not quite yet. I mean, I want to wait until I fully articulate my case for why I think people are nihilists. But certainly ignorance of what bankers do, of the value of banking, is a big part of it. There is a philosophical element, which I'll get to. There always is a philosophical element. But this is where I think nihilism does play a role. Among the Krugmans of the world, the Stiglitzes of the world, the people who know better, the economists and intellectuals who are smart enough to understand and have taken enough economic classes to understand the productive role of banking and how Wall Street is incredibly valuable, and that Wall Street didn't create the financial crisis, and it wasn't Glass-Steagall repeal that created the financial crisis, all that stuff, that is known within the economics field. That's known within the field of finance. So for the economists, for the sophisticated, for those kind of people to go after banking, to go after Wall Street, that they are nihilists. They are haters. They are doing it out of spite and out of envy. And then they are taking advantage of the ignorance and the just the innate distrust of bankers that exists out there in the culture. And we'll talk again about where that innate distrust comes from. It has a philosophical root, a strong philosophical root, but they're just exploiting that. That makes sense?
That does. Yeah, that clarifies it for me. Good. I appreciate that.
Well, thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling, and thanks for being a loyal listener to the show. I really appreciate it. You know, one of the real fun things about the show is I travel, as you know, all over the world. and all over the country. And I meet people everywhere who tell me they're avid listeners of the show. And that's always fun. I mean, it even happened to me. Tara Smith gave a talk here in Irvine a few days ago on judicial review on her latest book. This is Tara Smith, Dr. Tara Smith, who's on the board of directors of the Ayn Rand Institute. And I went to the talk, and a lot of people came up to me and told me that they listened to the show, that they really love the show, that they're regular listeners to the show. And that's really cool, and I really appreciate that. And it's really gratifying that so many of you are getting value out of me pontificating every week on a Saturday morning about a variety of different topics. Okay, we've got a caller from the 415 area code. Is that's a Bay Area?
Well, I'm actually living in New York City, but I grew up in San Francisco.
Okay, so you got a San Francisco cell phone. Who, what's your name?
Dave from New York. Right.
Another
now.
Dave. Okay, we got a couple of Dave.
It's funny.
So go
Dave
ahead,
from
Dave.
Portland usually calls first, and then I'm like right behind it. But
that's right, the 1-2 punch.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, okay, if like the American sense of life, you know, has kept us from becoming tyrannical, and why is Canada and Sweden freer than we are and more pro-banker than we are? Because they don't even have that philosophical foundation of rugged individualism. So how can countries be more capitalist than the United States?
I think that one of the answers to that, I mean, it's a really good question, and there are a number of answers to that. But one of them specifically about banking is that Europeans generally, and this applies to Canadians because as much as they hate to hear it, Canada's culture is a much stronger European influences than America's culture. Europeans, and this includes socialists, have accepted the banker state combination. So, and they have a long, long history of this. So they've just accepted the fact that they're going to be big banks, and that they, through government, can control those big banks. Whereas America, in its founding, was very suspicious of that teamwork between the banker and the politician. You know, again, they're kind of the Rothschilds and their association with the kings of Europe. Associated individualism and freedom with fragmentation. So it's not that the Swedes and the Canadians are free and we're not. It's not that the Swedes and Canadians are pro-banking and pro-free banking. They certainly are not. They heavily regulate. They just regulate less than us. It's just that they are comfortable with big banks and a strong influence of politics and banks and banks on politics. They bought into that and they accept it and it's fine. It's just like in Germany. It's not controversial that big companies have huge political sway. It's accepted that it's a partnership between government, unions, and business. So cronyism, if you will, in Europe is institutionalized. We still fight it. Part of that fight is we want to break the banks up. We want little tiny banks. You know, that's the way we fight. Instead of fighting cronyism by limiting government power, that's gone. So do you get the difference between kind of the American approach and the European approach?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
So the Europeans, it seems, okay, so it's a little more pragmatic and almost accidental that they'd even be ranked higher in terms of economic freedom than the United States.
Yes, but there's also another element. So let's take another element. It goes beyond banking. And this is that the Europeans have first-hand experience with real socialism, what I'll call real socialism. And what I consider real socialism is when the state owns the means of production. So, for example, in the 1980s, Mitterrand, I don't know how many of you remember Mitterrand, who was the French president, was elected, and he was a socialist, and he declared himself a socialist. And one of the first things he did as president of France was nationalize the banks, literally government takeover of the banks, right? Mm-hmm. And it failed. It was miserable. It was awful. And while the rest of Europe was, you know, doing really, really well economically, France plummeted and it was awful. And what he had to do was privatize them. He spun them off and privatized them all. So the Europeans have this experience with state ownership, and they rejected that. And so they And they haven't yet. Okay, so let's take America. America, in America, we've never had the inclination for state ownership. Indeed, America, I don't think, has ever had an inclination towards socialism. Even Bernie Sanders, I don't believe, is a socialist. Our inclination is towards fascism. Our inclination, and what I mean by fascism, is not state ownership of the means of production, by state control over the means of production. So we regulate banks to such an extent that we might as well own them. We almost own them today, but we do it through regulations. Now, the Europeans are adopting that methodology because they've experienced socialism, they've rejected it, and it's failed, and it's not being successful. So they're becoming more and more towards regulation. But in a sense, they're lagging us. We adopted the way to control the economy is not by the government, except for land. We, you know, the federal government owns 75% of all the land west of the Mississippi. But except for that, government doesn't own plants, it doesn't own equipment, it doesn't own businesses, it doesn't own banks, but it controls to such an extent that I would argue that the banking industry today has basically been taken over by the government. There is no, particularly if you're a big bank, there is no banking industry as a separate private industry. It's almost all in the hands of government. But the government isn't. And see, this is the beauty of the system. When a financial crisis happened, the government can say, well, we don't own the banks. It wasn't us. It's those bastards. You know, blame them. Don't blame us. Right? Whereas if they owned the banks, they would have to own up to the blame. So it's a great way for them to control while leaving the Americans, and this plays the American sense of life, leaving us with the illusion of private property, with the illusion that we still have private banks, with the illusion that we still have capitalism to some extent, but we really don't. It's just hidden from us. So last time I read this, and the statistic might be dated by a few years, 120 bank regulators went to work every day at the offices of J.P. Morgan. Literally at the offices of J.P. Morgan. You know, they have offices next to CEO, next to CFO, and they approve everything. So is that socialism? Yeah, by some definitions. But what it really is fascism. Because and it's much more – you see, in this way, this is much more sophisticated. Establishing the regulatory state is a much more sophisticated way of establishing statism over a country like America than is socialism, which Americans would reject outright. Americans would never vote for an out socialist who says I'm gonna take over, I'm gonna run Walmart now. No, we want Walmart to run, but we determine the minimum wage, we determine the terms by which they employ people, we maybe one day will determine what they buy, certainly what warning labels they have to have on everything that they sell, you know, what kind of gas their trucks have to be powered by, what kind of electricity they buy. We'll do all of that. But we won't own Walmart because the American people will never accept ownership of Walmart. And that's why I believe strongly that statism will, you know, when we become authoritarian in this country, totalitarian in this country, it will be through fascism, not through socialism. So that's part of it. So right now in Europe, the egalitarian tendencies forces taxes and redistribution to be greater than it is in the United States, although even that is changing for a variety of reasons. Even that, but because they have actually the European welfare state is much more efficient than the American welfare state. We have the most inefficient, stupid redistribution of wealth mechanisms in the world. Again, because we keep trying to deny we're doing it because we don't want to piss off the American sense of life. So we call Social Security and Medicare, they're not redistribution of wealth. You've earned it, right? So they're stupid. Whereas in Europe, it's just everybody knows what they are. So we run very inefficient welfare state programs because we keep couching it in, it's not welfare, right? We pretend.
How do you run it efficiently?
What's that?
How do you run it efficiently? How is there an efficient welfare state?
Well, there isn't an efficient welfare state, but let's just say to get a dollar to a poor person in Scandinavia to steal a dollar from me and give it to a poor person in Scandinavia, there are far fewer transaction costs in the middle than there are in the United States.
Okay.
And actually, Finland is talking about moving to the most efficient way of doing that, which is, you know, I'll do a show at some point on this, which is a minimum guaranteed income, which is an interesting idea if you're...
Those Milton Friedman's.
What's that? It's a kind of a Milton Friedman idea of making the welfare state efficient, right? And they're going to adopt it before we do. Because we don't want... Americans resist the welfare state because of the sense of life. So they don't want it to be efficient, and they don't even want to know that it exists to some extent. So they give it different names, and they label it different things, and, you know, it's food stamps, it's this and that. So we have 1,000 different programs to help poor people, right, that we call 1,000 different names just so that we can pretend that we still have a small welfare state, when if you aggregate it all up, it's almost as big as the Europeans. But in Europe, what happens is they redistribute more than we do, but they regulate less. And I think that's just a matter of catching up, because the European Union in Brussels would like to regulate a lot more than the individual countries do. That's one of the big conflicts around the European Union, and the stress within the European Union is about the level of regulations. Brussels wants to regulate a lot, and many of the European Union countries actually want to regulate less. And then finally, and then I have to go back to the topic, I'll say this. The American sense of life is fading. You know, when you read Ayn Rand talking about the American sense of life, that was over 30 years ago. You know, that's a generation ago. And there is no question. And Leonard Peikoff, if you listen to his talk, Americans versus America, Americans have turned against America, what America represents. He says in that talk that was given, I think, in the late 2000s, that the Americans, we are losing. Every decade, we lose some of that sense of life. Every decade is less of it. And you can see it in the popularity of Bernie Sanders, and you can see it in the popularity of Donald Trump. Both candidates are anti-American candidates in a sense of what America represents. And yet, they're incredibly popular. So, you know, that we like as objectivists to hold on to that notion of American sense of life that Ayn Rand talked about. But that was a long, long, long time ago. And the world is much, much, much worse. America is in many respects philosophically and in terms of sense of life, much, much, much worse, as sad as it is. And getting worse, given this presidential campaign. Who could have imagined that these two pure, pure populists would be leading the polls? So anyway, sorry to end on that pessimistic note, Dave.
Yeah.
But hopefully that answers your question.
Yes, I was wondering, well, also I saw your video on anti-Semitism and related, I guess, to banking and capitalism.
Yep.
Do you think this is why there's been this kind of influx in anti-Israeli anti-Semitism with this hatred of banking since the 2008 crisis?
Yes, I do.
The amount of anti-Semitism is just out of control. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely, and it really is. It's connected to two things. It's connected to angst post 9/11, and blaming among libertarians, and then also among the radical left. The libertarians and some libertarians and the radical left often share things in common. The blaming of 9/11 on our relationship with Israel. And in Europe, with the terrorist attacks in Paris and places like that, the French have lashed out at the Jews in France as this is the reason. They're the fault. The Muslims hate us because of the Jews. They don't lash out at the Muslims. They lash out at the Jews, which is interesting. And so that's one. But yes, the anti-capitalist, anti-banking that has really flourished since the 2008 crisis has encouraged anti-Semitism. The Jews have always been associated with banking for a reason I'll articulate in a minute. And therefore, when anti-banking sentiment increases, anti-Jew sentiment increases. Great. Dave, thanks. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening to the show. Let me get back to the topic because, you know, I always think, what am I going to talk about for an hour and a half? I'm going to run out of stuff to say. And of course, now I'm in a position where I've got less than half an hour to go and way too much to talk about, right? Way too much. But I really appreciate the calls. I think the calls make the show much more interesting and much more fun and much more challenging for me because I never know what kind of questions you have. I do encourage those of you who are listening who don't agree with me on anything, please call. I love hostile questions. I love challenging questions. I love people who don't agree with what I say asking me questions. So please call and ask questions on disagreement on any topic. Anyway, there is a big fact of ignorance with regard to banking. And that fact has to do with the fact that finance and banking is complicated. And that banking is a very abstract, difficult activity. It's not like building something directly and you can see the product. It is the activity that makes the building of products possible because it provides the capital for them. But that's removed from the product. And then when you get to derivatives, which are involved in reducing the risk so that you can provide capital to make products possible, that's 2 degrees of order removed from the product itself. It's hard. It's conceptual. It's sophisticated. It's complicated. And people are ignorant. They don't understand it. They don't get it. Even when you teach it and explain it to them, they don't get it. I mean, people don't have any understanding of basic, simple economics. Minimum wage laws, how those destroy employment, supply and demand, basic concept in supply and demand. Where does wealth come from? The importance of entrepreneurs. They don't get that. But when it comes to banking, it's even more complicated. And what they certainly don't get is what I believe is that banking, finance, is of all the economic activities in capitalism, in a free market, it's the most important one. It's the most productive one. This is why bankers make so much money. Why financiers make so much money? Because they add the most to the productive process. Now, how can that be, Iran? That sounds nuts, right? I mean, they're just paper shufflers, Donald Trump has told us, and Bernie Sanders has seconded. It's because bankers are the decision makers about what will get produced and what will not. What businesses will survive and what will die? Who gets financed and who does not? And what's interesting is when people try to convince Americans to like bankers, and this was in the Gallup poll that I talked about a few minutes ago, what they talk about is, look, the banker helped you buy a home, and look, they helped you with the credit. Even though you have a low credit rating, they gave you credit anyway to buy a car and whatever, right? They think about consumers. And that's all true. Without bankers, our ability to consume would be hampered dramatically. Think about how could you afford to buy a house if you didn't have a mortgage? If somebody didn't take a risk on you through a mortgage? And you would have to save and save and save and save and save until you had all the money to put down on a house. Let's say the house costs $1 million. You'd have to save $1 million to buy a $1 million house. And yet, because of banking, save $100,000 or $200,000, much more doable, put that money down and take out an $800,000 mortgage and buy a house. So it's wonderful for consumers, but that's not what's important about banking. I mean, I love banks because I live at a much higher standard of living than I could if not for banks. They improve my standard of living just as a consumer because of credit cards, because of mortgages, because of auto loans, because of all that. I drive a nicer car. I live in a nicer house. Earlier in life, I get more years to appreciate it than I would if I had to save up to buy all those things. I call it consumption smoothing. I mean, I don't call that. It's called in finance consumption smoothing. They facilitate consumption smoothing. And that raises the standard of living dramatically over a lifetime. But that's not the essential function of banks. The essential function of banks is to provide capital to businesses, to allocate capital across the and this is I'm talking about financiers broadly, to allocate capital across financial markets and across industries, across the entire country, the entire spectrum of productive activities. They get to decide. It's financiers who get to decide when the buggy industry needs to die and when an auto industry needs to rise. Now, today, government decides. The government right now is deciding that electric cars are cool, and they're going to, they've made electric cars a priority, and it looks like they're going to make it even more so. Certainly, if a Democrat wins the White House, we're going to have huge subsidies for electric cars, and they're deciding what kind of cars Detroit should produce. Now, the consequences of that are going to be pretty horrific, and they already are in terms of wasted capital. And so often we don't see the consequence when government steps in. But in a normal environment, it is bankers who do this or financiers who do this. They withdraw capital from the dying industry and give masses of capital to the growing industry. So at the turn of the century or early part of the 20th century, they withdrew capital by selling stock, by not giving loans to, by not issuing bonds for the buggy industry, and they poured money into the auto industry by IPOs, by giving them loans, by floating bonds. And this is, this is the beauty of finance. Now, you see it in Silicon Valley, in venture capital. Hundreds of people walk into the venture capitalist's office pitching business plans. 99% of them are stupid, and thank God nobody funds. 1% of them are decent, and they get funded. But even that, out of that 1%, only some are successful in raising a second round or a third round and actually becomes companies. But imagine if a government bureaucrat was doing that, or if I was doing that, or if you were doing that with no skill. We would be wasting capital. So the capitalist is the one who allocates the capital in a way that is productive, in a way that maximizes their return, which means productive, which means maximizing profits. And most people are just ignorant of this idea, completely ignorant of this idea. And of course, without derivatives, a lot of this allocation of capital wouldn't happen because you wouldn't be able to control for risk. And it is the banker, the capitalist, who creates jobs, all the jobs in the economy to some extent or another. Because let's take a biotech company. You've got a great idea for a new drug, and you need to hire a bunch of scientists to go into a lab for 10 years to figure this out. Or you go to a venture capitalist, and they give you enough money. So, if there were no venture capitalists, you would have to find scientists who were willing basically to work for free for 10 years. I have no idea how you would buy the equipment and the lab and all the other stuff. Because the capitalist is willing to give you the money up front without any guarantee of return on that money, any guarantee of return, you can pay salaries, you can buy the equipment, you can build a facility, you can execute on the plan. So all these employees who are not willing to take the risk by not getting paid for 10 years are getting paid. So they're getting guaranteed return. They're getting money. And the capitalist is sitting there with a piece of paper, which is the stock in this thing, hoping that it will be successful. And only when it is successful do they make their money back. I mean, this is the most important function, the most unappreciated function in the entire economy. You wouldn't have a job if not for them. Nobody would have a job if not for them. Okay, I must have stepped on, I must have triggered something because I'm suddenly getting a bunch of people calling in. So let's do that. We might have to pick this topic up in a future show because I might not actually finish it, but I do want to address these callers. So hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hey, Yaron, it's Jonathan. Great show.
Hey, Jonathan, a financier calling in. This is great.
Well, I just had to quickly mention, is there a more evil description for somebody now than to call them a hedge fund manager? I think it's probably the worst of the worst when it comes to financiers. And, quickly, I'll just share a story you had mentioned. I talked to a guy who has done some lobbying for the hedge fund industry, and during the big regulatory push with Dodd-Frank, the long story short is that he had to explain to the clerks of the lawmakers who were writing the rule just exactly what hedge funds were. So to your point, they don't see the benefit of a credit default swap because not only do they know, they don't know what it is, all they know is that it's being peddled by a greedy, profit-seeking banker. And God knows that's terrible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, you're absolutely right. Today, there's nothing worse than being called a hedge fund manager. And, of course, you're seeing this both from Donald Trump and from all these Democrats running. So there's nobody to defend the hedge fund guys, even on financial television, other than you, Jonathan, and a handful of others. But they're really being abandoned completely by the political system and by the people who should know better, kind of financial reporters and economists who should understand it.
I'll quickly just say, and I'll let you get to all your other calls, but so far there's only been three advertisements run for
yep.
hedge funds in the last 80 years, and two of the three of them have been run by explicit objectivists, and I think that's something we can be proud of.
Absolutely, and one of them was yours, at least one of them was yours, so congratulations, Jonathan, that's huge. So we're going to change the world. One little
step
at a time.
Keep up the work.
We are going to do it. Thanks, Jonathan. And yeah, let me just say something quickly about hedge fund managers, because again, I know a lot of people who hate hedge fund managers, but how many people actually know what they do? And for the most part, hedge fund managers take out inefficiencies from financial markets. They adjust prices to reflect better and more meaningful information. They arbitrage to make sure that financial markets are all reflecting, in a sense, the same and hopefully the best information. They make money for investors. You know, so they are providing an important economic function within the economic system, which allows for an efficient distribution of capital. Because when you have misprices in financial markets, that means capital is going to be allocated unproductively. Hedge funds try and do successfully and sometimes unsuccessfully is eliminate those mispricings so that now they're doing it to make money. But the impact economically is that capital is allocated more effectively, more efficiently. Okay, we got one more call. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart, how's it going?
Well, it's going great. I want to ask you about selling short. A lot of people tell me that if I'm betting that within the month, you know, the price of sugar will go down and I profit from that, they say, well, you're not financing a business. Aren't you a parasite?
Great. No, great question.
On that.
Thanks, Stuart. I'm going to take it offline because I'm going to kind of rush through the answer to be able to wrap up the show. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think selling short is somehow wrong, is somehow immoral and economically unproductive. And what is selling short? Selling short is basically you borrow stock, you sell it, and at some point you have to buy it back and return it to the person you borrowed it from. So you're hoping, in a sense, you're betting on the stock going down, and by selling it, you're actually helping the stock go down. You make money. If the stock goes up, you lose money, and you could lose a lot of money. I can tell you stories, and maybe I will, about shorts going wrong. So short is a very, very risky strategy. Very risky strategy. When you buy a stock, you can only lose what you paid for the stock. You can make, theoretically, an infinite amount, right? When you short a stock, you can only make the value of the stock, the price of the stock, but you can lose potentially an infinite number, right? Somebody online guessed my story about selling short. I must have told it somewhere so they know. Anyway, if I have time, I'll tell it. But what are you doing when you're selling short? You believe that a stock or a bond or any other financial instrument is overpriced. And that means that by selling short, you are helping to move that price down. Now, if it really is overpriced, then by moving the price down, you are, again, making the price be more reflective of the truth, more reflective of the real value of this business. So that when, again, capital is allocated, this business gets a more objective value, a more objective amount of capital based on a more objective price, a more objective valuation. So short sellers are helping establish, based on the information that they have, and I'm assuming you're not short selling just stupidly, because if you are, that's fine. You'll just lose money very, very quickly, and you'll be wiped out of business. I'm assuming that short sellers are shorting because they have better information. They know something about the businesses that other people don't know, that they have figured something out that other people don't know, and sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. But when they're right, they should get rewarded for it, because by shorting, they have improved the efficiency of the price. And by improving the efficiency of the price of the asset, they have improved the allocation of capital in the economy. So hopefully that makes sense, right? So, I mean, this can be complicated, because stock markets, because they're secondary markets, what I mean by secondary markets, the money is, when you buy a stock, the money's not going from you to the stockholder. The money is not going from you to, not the stockholder, to the company. The money's not going to the company. The money is actually going to somebody else who owns the stock, who used to own the stock and now you bought it. So people say it's a zero-sum game, right? If you make money, that person lost money. You know, that's it. But that's not true. Because price of the stock is incredibly important to determining many things about the company. So when we trade, and to the extent that our trading impacts the price, if we sell, we're giving a positive signal. If we sell, we're giving a negative signal. If we buy, we're giving a positive signal, with the idea that if we sell, we believe that the stock is overpriced. If we buy, we believe the stock is underpriced. That ultimately moves the stock price to a better place, a more informative place, which again impacts the way capital is allocated in the economy, even though capital is not directly allocated through your purchase or sell of the stock. So again, a little complicated. I go into a lot of more depth in this in a course that I give that's available on the Ayn Rand bookstore. Just Google Ayn Rand bookstore, and it's called In Defense of Financial Markets. It's a long course basically covering the topic that we're covering here, but where I really delve into how is the stock market productive and in what sense is it productive. So I talk about derivatives and I talk about all these different financial instruments. So I would recommend that you look for that. I also talk about these issues, particularly issues that concern, it seems, libertarians who don't trust corporations. I talk about those in another lecture course that I give that's available in the e-store called Decorporation. And then there are on YouTube a number of lectures that I've given just in defense of finance, which I think you might find interesting. And, of course, we haven't talked about fractional reserve banking. We really don't have time. But let's do this. Next week, I am not here. So next week's show will be a show by let me just see how I find this. Next week's show will be with Don Watkins. And I think I've already got the title of the show. Yes, next week's show is called Objectivism is a Tool for Success and Happiness. And it's going to be a show where Don Watkins interviews Alex Epstein. So you probably followed Alex's work at the Center for Industrial Progress. Maybe followed his work when he worked at the Ayn Rand Institute and his book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. And Don will be talking about with Alex, but not about kind of a policy issue, not about oil, not about energy, but more about how do you apply objectivism as a tool for success and happiness, right? How do you apply objectivism as a tool for success? So I think it's going to be a terrific show. I encourage you all to listen. That is next week, same time. 2 weeks from now, we're going to do part two of this. So next week for now, we're going to pick up on financiers and bankers, and we're going to talk about fractional reserve, and we're going to talk about any other issues you want. And we'll make it explicitly more of a call-in show. I'll encourage calls and just any questions about these kind of issues. In the future, we'll do kind of a Q&A show. We'll do a show with an open Q&A where you can call in on anything. But unfortunately, no more questions today just because I've got 4 minutes until the show ends, and I really do have to end the show because I've got another show in less than an hour on AM 560 in Chicago. So let me end by making a very quick movie recommendation for a movie I saw over the holidays, and I don't think I recommended it here. It's not going to be a strong recommendation, but I enjoyed it. It's a show with called Joy, and it's quirky. The movie's quirky. Stylistically, I don't know if I liked it. I can't quite tell. But it had a very, very unique quality. And by the way, we can talk about insider trading as well. We can talk about a lot of stuff. So the AM560 you can listen to live. For those of you listening live right now, you can listen to live on iHeartRadio.com. If you go to iHeartRadio, and you search there for AM560 Chicago. It's the answer, AM560, the answer. In exactly an hour at 2 o'clock Pacific time, you'll be able to hear my show there where I'll be talking about Bernie Sanders. I'll be talking about Bernie Sanders and populism, continuing my discussion of populism. And then later in the week, the AM560 show is uploaded to Block Talk Radio. But anyway, I want to talk quickly about Joy. Which is a movie about the woman who created this mop, right? She invented this mop, and it's just a wonderful movie about somebody who is an entrepreneur, but not an entrepreneur in technology or something like that. Just somebody who invented a mop, and perseverance and success. And the people who helped her to be successful, and in this case, it was a greedy capitalist television shopping networks. You get a little flavor of the history of the late 70s in terms of the shopping networks, and I found that interesting, and just how stuff was sold in those days. And it's just a very encouraging, positive movie about QVC, about the shopping channel, but really about this lady, about this woman. It's based on a true story. It's quite fictionalized. She has lots of problems, personal problems, and she makes, I think, a few on the personal side of her life. Unfortunately, she's quite an altruist, but she stands up for her beliefs. She stands up for what she really believes in. She follows through. She doesn't give up. She goes for it. She convinces people who seem unconvincible. And she becomes hugely rich and hugely successful. And she's not a one-shot wonder. She actually has multiple patents over multiple products. And wow, I admire this lady. And for me to go to a movie, and at the end of the movie, I walk away admiring a business person, an entrepreneur who was portrayed in the movie. That's unbelievably rare, and that should be celebrated. So in spite of the quirks, in spite of the depiction of her personal life, despite of the fact that I don't particularly like this director, I really enjoyed this is Jennifer Lawrence in Joy. So, it's about an entrepreneur. It's about a dreamer who doesn't give up, who succeeds. And, yeah, I got tears in my eyes at the end of the movie, tears of joy from her success. So I'm giving it away in the sense that she succeeded. But the movie's name is Joy, J-O-Y. So and it's in the theaters, I think, right now. I don't think it's nominated for an Academy Award. I think she might be nominated, but the movie itself is not nominated. But I encourage you all to go see it, enjoy it. Remember to tune in next week to hear Don Watkins and Alex Epstein talking about objectivism as a tool for happiness and success. And in 2 weeks, so I'll be, next week I'll be in Beijing. Wish me luck. I'll be in, I fly to Tokyo tomorrow. I do 3 talks in Tokyo. I do a seminar, a weekend-long seminar on business ethics in Beijing to entrepreneurs and academics and students. And then I'm giving a couple of talks in Hong Kong. Okay, last pitch. If you know anybody in Hong Kong who might be interested in attending, who has money and who has resources, who might be interested in supporting an Ayn Rand Center Asia, drop me a note. I'd like to invite him to a dinner that we're hosting in Hong Kong in a week and a half. So I'll see you when I get back to China. I'm sure I'll have lots of stories. We'll do part 2 of this show on financiers. And have a great rest of the weekend, and we'll talk soon. This has been, you've been listening to the Yaron Brooks Show.